The Angie's List you know and trust is now Angie, and we're so much more than just a list. We still connect you with top local pros and show you ratings and reviews, but now we also let you compare upfront prices on hundreds of projects and book a service instantly. We can even handle the rest of your project from start to finish. So remember, Angie's List is now Angie, and we're here to get your job done right. Get started at Angie.com. That's A-N-G-I, or download the app today.
And the podcast is back. It's Carson Daly. I am in New York City. I am a former MTV VJ and proud to be a very, very small fraction of this, the Golf Pass Rory McIlroy podcast with the man himself, the third-ranked golfer on planet Earth, who joins us from 1000 North, which is a beautiful restaurant. They're our partners in Jupiter, Florida. Rory McIlroy, good to see you, buddy. How are you feeling today?
Good to see you. Yeah, I'm good, Carson. Thanks.
It's been a minute. We got a lot to get into, buddy. I want to congratulate you on the big win up in the Canadian territory up there. You had a great, great week. We're looking forward to hearing about that Sunday round, so we'll chat about that. We'll also look back. We got a couple of majors that you and I haven't had a chance to catch up on. The PGA, which was out of my neck of the woods in New York. Also, the U.S. Open at Pebble Beach. And then, of course, we have to really start to focus in on the upcoming Open Championship because it'll be a homecoming for you. Lots to get to on the podcast with Rory McIlroy and me, Carson Daly, coming up.
If you want more, we're going to give you more. Rory!
Well, we start right off the bat with Rory. I've missed you, buddy. I really love doing the podcast. I swear to God, next year I'm going to quit all my jobs. I'm just going to be your digital podcast caddy and just travel with you so we can do these things weekly and be a little more efficient at, you know, getting into your mind because according to Twitter, I need to shut the hell up, and we need more Rory McIlroy on the podcast.
52 podcasts a year. That's that's ambitious.
Yeah. I might have to just jump on your bag at that point.
There you go.
So where are you at right now? What's happening with you? Are you on a little bit of downtime?
Yeah, so I sort of built in this 3 week break after the U.S. Open. Feel like I played a lot up until that point, and then after this little break, I'm playing 7 of the next 8 weeks. So it's pretty busy. So we spent a week out in California after Pebble Beach, and then just been down in Florida for the last few days and getting back into practicing and getting ready for this run of golf I got coming up.
Rory, you're having, I mean, what a lot of people are saying is just one of the best golf seasons really in the history of the PGA Tour. I mean, aside from not winning a major yet, all the stats, does it feel that way to you? I mean, you've got 9 months, only one missed cut. You've top 10'd or won everything else, 11 top 10s and 14 starts. Does it feel that way to you?
It does. It's a weird one because it's felt like a really really good season without much fanfare. I've been very happy with my performances, obviously the two wins at the Players in Canada, but you know, it's ultimately with the way the game is and what people are focusing on, you know, if you don't win a major, it's, you know, people are sort of wondering what's wrong or what's, you know, why not or what's happening. So, you know, I think if I keep playing the way I've been playing and, you know, if I'm consistent and I'm putting in these performances, you know, at regular PGA Tour events, you know, there's no reason why that doesn't carry over into the majors at some point.
Why is that? Why is everybody so obsessed with the majors? You know, it's always bothered me, the conversation about Tiger's comeback. It was like, can he come back? Like, literally, can he play 4 rounds of golf competitively again and maybe make the cut and be like top 25? Then he goes ahead and wins, and immediately the national conversation, especially within the game of golf, is like, oh no, the ultimate litmus is a major. It's like, well, 6 months ago, you were wondering if the guy could even like finish a PGA Tour event, which he does. Then he wins one. Now it's a major. I mean, that measuring stick, doesn't that drive you nuts?
It does, and if anything, I blame Jack Nicklaus. He was the one that really started to focus on the majors back in the day, and it's just become the popular narrative. And I think, you know, a little bit like tennis in some way as well. You know, the casual fan tunes in 4 times a year, and that's the way it is. And if you don't perform those four times a year, or don't win one of those four, you know, people are going to start asking questions. But I wish people took a little bit more heed of week to week, because I think the depth of the PGA Tour is as strong as it ever has been, and to win out there is as tough as it ever has been. So,
right.
You know, that's why I can't let what people say or not say get to me. I know in my mind that I'm having a great season, and, you know, I'm happy, and that's the most important thing.
So the 3 weeks that you've built in here before you go home, would you have done that 3 weeks regardless? Is that normal?
Yeah, I think with the new schedule change, there's a lot more golf, a lot more golf. It's not as spread out as it used to be. You know, the season used to go from, you know, whenever, January through to September, sort of end of September. We're now, like, the playoffs end in August, and it's just so much, it's much more condensed. So you're playing more regularly, and I think it's important to build those breaks in from time to time.
We'll get into a little bit more of the preview of the Open in just a minute. Let's go back, though, because we talked a little bit about the Masters on the last podcast. Then you went to Wells Fargo. You were T8 there. But a couple of majors we want to get to. In March, you were here on Long Island for the PGA Championship. The noteworthy thing there for me was that I had no idea Bethpage Black. I brought Jackson, who you've met, my 10-year-old son, out to follow you. And I didn't realize that course, for casual golfers who are listening to us right now, know that, you know, predominantly most golf courses, you know, they're sort of out and back, and usually you can get a beer at like 9. There's a halfway shack of some sort. Bethpage is built where it's just out and out, and I didn't realize that. So I have like my son, I have like two of his friends, they're 10 years old. I've got like, I'm double fisted with beers, and like we're walking down one. Then we
hopefully not for the kids.
Yeah, no, for me, because I don't know when I'm going to see another beer shack.
They were always single fisting.
Yeah, thank you, producer Ryan. So yeah, they had double cokes. But, like, that golf course is, once you cross the road, is that after one or two when you cross the road?
After one, yeah.
So after one, once you're out, you're out. So we took the venture up, but I only made it about 5 holes because these kids, that's a tough golf course to walk.
It is. It's really tough. And you're right. It is. It's, you know, once you're out there, you are out there. Even so, at the PGA Championship, they use a 2-tee start. So on Friday morning, I'm teeing off 10. And I sort of want to give myself enough time to get to the tee, but it's literally a 20-minute drive from the practice range to the 10th tee.
Right, and then more than 10 at Pebble.
Yeah, more than 10 at Pebble for sure. Yeah. Probably double the time. Yeah, I think at Pebble it might only been 7 or 8 minutes, but it was literally 20 minutes, and it felt like I needed another warm up before I teed off again. Yeah. You know, all the warm up I did on the range, it's like, geez, I feel like I need to hit a few balls.
Yeah, it's like ice in the kicker.
Yeah, exactly.
How did that week feel like for you? I know that when you were out there, you didn't start so strong, but you sure as hell finished strong. What was your takeaway from the PGA?
Yeah, I thought, you know, it was, you know, it's a great golf course. I think what Brooks did over the first two, he obviously won the golf tournament, but what he did over the first 2 days, separating himself from the field like that, was really impressive. I struggled. I didn't hit the fairways I needed to hit the first 2 days. I scrambled. I made the cut. And then I had a great finish, finished in the top 10, had two good, you know, I think I had the best score of the weekend, I guess, the last 2 days. So, you know, overall, you know, considering the start, I thought it was a pretty good week. You know, as I said, Brooks was so good from the start and separated himself. And, you know, by, you know, going into Saturday, all I was trying to do was, you know, finish the tournament as high as I could.
You know, it's funny. Let's talk about Brooks for just a quick second. From a novice perspective, you know, he seems like a guy, when I watch him on TV, he's just like the ultimate jock. He's like guys I went to high school with. He backs up his whatever bravado he may show. I got no problem with him. He doesn't seem overly arrogant, overly ego-driven. He seems like Superman to me when I look at him. He's physically a beast. He goes into obvious beast mode in these majors. His interviews post-match are, you know, he's a straight shooter. There's nothing annoying about him. How is he looked at from within the tour?
Yeah, I mean, I think anyone that knows Brooks really respects him and likes him. You know, he lives down here in Jupiter, and, you know, he I think sometimes gets a not a bad rap, but like he you know, he said in Canada the week before the U.S. Open, you know, well, I'm here because I know if I was at home, I wouldn't practice. So at least I'm here and I'm going to play some golf. So he, you know, he likes to.
Why do people have a problem with that?
I think it again, it's the popular narrative or opinion that you got to work hard and you got to. But, you know, if you're, you know, he's got, you know, people wouldn't look at Brooks and think like naturally talented golfer, but he is. I mean, he, you know. He does
Clearly.
It his own way. But, you know, I think he has really found something that works for him in the majors, like a mentality more so than anything else. And
yeah.
At this point, it's now, you know, trying to take that mentality from the majors just into every other week on tour because,
right.
you know, we see him and he plays so well in these majors and, you know, sometimes finds it hard to replicate that when maybe the intensity isn't as high. So, you know, he's obviously good enough. Geez, he's the number one player in the world right now. And, you know, he's going to be a force to be reckoned with, you know, obviously in the majors, but, you know, even more so than that, he's 29 years old. He's got a lot of, you know, a lot of time ahead of him. And, you know, he's a gritty competitor.
You know, it reminds me, it sounds like the kid who's in like seventh grade and who's bored. And the teacher tells the parents, like, look, your kid's getting all C's. And they're like, oh, crap, my kid's, you know, just not pulling their load. And the teacher looks at the parents like, no, he's bored because he's just smarter than everybody else in this class. We need him to like move him or her to move up a grade. Brooks seems to have that almost, not that he's bored week in and week out, but the dude is so like Captain America beast mode that maybe in the majors, like, he needs that sort of a rush. It's like Jordan, when he goes out to play golf, these guys gamble because it's the only way to possibly replicate a real pressure, real life scenario. And they happen to be very wealthy. So it's like, hey, 50 grand says you miss that 6-foot putt. Like maybe he just needs the rush and maybe it's hard for critical mass to sort of understand that sort of athleticism.
That's a very valid.
That's very deep.
It is very deep, a very valid
is that too
point.
Deep? Even, do you like, what's your,
no,
Bruce Ryan,
no,
what's
that,
your take
that,
on Koepka?
That's my, I mean, what you just said about the, you know, the kid that's bored in fourth grade and you need to move him up a grade or you need
yeah.
to, I mean, that's sort of what it looks like. I mean, obviously I haven't really had this conversation with Brooks, but I, you know, it seems like he can't get the rush from the regular events and he gets that rush from the majors.
I think right. he's kind of the villain that golf needs. Like he's a little bit polarizing. Like I have.
I don't think he's a villain
me.
Though. I don't think he's.
I don't think he is.
Gary Woodland looked
perception.
More like a villain to me than Brooks Koepka. I don't know anything about Gary Woodland, and I met him at the Today Show after he won, and I love the guy. I mean, I sized him up totally wrong. Listen, you guys are inside the sport. For us golf fans, we sit on our couches, we watch golf on the weekends, and we just size people up. It's literally high school. You look at that guy, and you're like, oh, I went to school with a guy like that. The way his shoulders are back, the way he walks, he's probably cocky. He looks like he's from Long Island. You make all these assertions, of course, none of them are true. And then I've met Gary when he's on Today Show, and he was one of the most lovely human beings I've ever met. I'm pulling for him now. But listen, this is the way the world works. I don't get a villain thing from Brooks at all.
I don't know. I like, you know, he definitely needs, he will take any slight, you know, that is, he uses that as fuel. So whether, you know, the Golf Channel don't have his name up in the notables, or
Fox Sports doesn't put him in the promo,
or someone spells his name wrong on the leaderboard, whatever
Bruce.
It may be. Like it's he uses all of that to like fuel him and trying to prove people wrong. I think
but
that's his
should.
Real desire for sure. I mean, but you know, there's only, I, in my opinion, there's only so long that can last. You know, you use all these things, but you're going to run out of things to try to prove to people. You know, you're gonna have to use something else.
I don't know. Zion Williamson was drafted, you know, number one out of North Carolina, and there was a great photograph I saw like a month ago, and it was like press day, and he had all the press, and there was a kid sitting next to him. I don't know if you saw this picture.
Yeah, I did.
And
I saw it. Yeah.
Was it RJ Barrett? It was another guy who went first round, and he literally had nobody around him. And I was listening to Stephen A. Smith on ESPN. He was like, or somebody on ESPN, a talking head, and they said, you know what, if I were that kid, it might have been Jalen Rose. He was like, I would take that picture, I would put it up in my locker, I'd put it in my bathroom mirror, and every day I wake up, I would look at that and I go, I got work to do today. So I don't mind Brooks Koepka. I mean, he's backing it up. If he's got to find one thing or the other each week to be his motivation, I mean, I guess it's working, so be it.
Exactly. It is working. That's, you know, no one can argue with that.
To your point, though, how long can he sustain that? I don't know. Maybe he's got to win in, like, the DR or, like, Puerto Rico or, you know, an event that isn't a major. Maybe if he wins there, that'll be the thing that does it for him. I don't know.
We shall see.
We shall see. We will see. So you played so well, as we mentioned, over the weekend in New York. Had a miscut at the Memorial, but then you come back and, like, in Canada, walk me through that month. How do you do that?
Yeah, it's weird. So, you know, I had a week off after the PGA. I did some work with my coach Michael Bannon down here in Jupiter, and I went to Memorial feeling pretty good about my game. But I don't think the week after the PGA, I didn't spend a lot of time on the golf course. I spent a lot of time on the range working on some stuff, and I got to Memorial, and it's really playing golf, like, you learn so much more about your game on the golf course than you do on the range. And I struggled those first 2 days, obviously, at Memorial. Missed the cut, but, you know, I said it at the time, this could, I saw some shots the first 2 days there. I was like, geez, that's not me. I need to go work on this. And it gave me an extra couple of days to work on some things. And I got to Canada and I felt like a different player. I felt like a different person just by having those two rounds in Ohio and getting that sort of bad golf out of my system. You know, I went to Canada with a lot more comfort and obviously everything that transpired there.
I mean, can you let us in a little bit more? Like, was it something in your swing? I mean, what do you learn in 36 holes of golf, being as good as you are, that propels you to the type of week you had in Canada?
Yeah, so I was working a lot on my posture and a lot on setup down here going into Memorial. And I let that become too much what I was thinking of on the golf course. So instead of thinking about the shot I'm going to hit, I'm thinking more about my posture, and I was thinking more golf swing instead of just, you know, playing golf. And you know, I think if you do enough work away from the golf course, that'll just sort of start to bed into your game without you actually having to really think about it. So that's sort of what I realized over those first 2 days, and my wedge play was atrocious the first 2 days at Memorial. So it gave me a little bit of time to work on my wedges, dial in my numbers, hit my numbers, work on TrackMan a little bit. It just gave me a little bit of extra time. And I felt, you know, from being a little uncertain going into the Memorial, I was a lot more certain of where my game was going into Canada.
What was that Sunday round like? Was it special for you as it was for us to watch as you flirted with 59?
So I keep saying this to everyone. I have never been as disappointed to win a golf tournament. Once I tapped in on 18 in Canada, I said to myself, Rory, don't forget to smile. Like, you've just won here. Because I wanted to shoot 59.
I didn't even know if you were that on it or cared that much about that stat.
Yeah. So, I mean, I knew by like the 13th hole, I was going to win the tournament. The tournament was, in my mind, the tournament was over, and the last five holes were all about trying to see if you can shoot 59.
No kidding.
And yeah, and I had chances, and, you know, again, it was wonderful to win the tournament, and the crowds in Canada were unbelievable, and, you know, it was a really cool scene, but there was just something there that was, you know, and I consciously was thinking, okay, don't say you're disappointed in that interview. Don't say you're, because you want to seem genuinely happy. You've just won a big event. It means a lot to the people up there. It means a lot to me. But inside, I was just like, oh, I had chances. But, you know, I it's some of the best golf.
But you won. I'm sorry. That sucks.
Yeah, no, I won for sure. But it's some of the best golf I've played in the last few years. So I was, you know, obviously you have to take the positives. I mean, I won the thing by 7 shots, but, you know, I hope there's some point in my career where I get another chance to shoot 59 and I take it, because, you know, if I go through my career and I don't get another chance, that would be a little disappointing.
When you have a round like that, and the Canadian fans, I thought, were awesome because
they were
lining
so
the fairway.
Yeah.
They were loud. They were into it. But when you're in that type of zone, are you in tunnel vision? Like, are you in to where you can't even notice, like, if there were two guys fighting on the left side of the fairway, like, would it even, like, click unless Harry pointed it out to you?
So I'm going to go a little deep here. So you know, I talked to some people and we, you know, what is the zone or getting in that flow state, as some psychologists call it, or, you know, where does that come from? And there's been a lot of studies on it and a lot of studies on the prefrontal cortex. And that is where it comes from in the brain. So, okay. And there's things you can do to train that prefrontal cortex. You know, that part of your brain controls, you know, getting in that flow state, but also cognition and rational thinking and decision making and all of that sort of, you know, all of that stuff. And wow. There are things you can do to train, or at least there are things you can do to not inhibit that part of your brain from working the way it should work. So one of the big studies that was done was involuntarily reaching for your phone and mindlessly scrolling through something on your phone. That inhibits your prefrontal cortex from working the way it should. So I thought, oh, that's really interesting. That's, you know, I'll from time to time during the day, you know, I'll pick up my phone and scroll through Instagram, and then you go down the rabbit hole and you're seven ways, you know, down.
You're like, I don't even know that person. Why am I following looking at their family photos?
Exactly. So that's mindless scrolling, and that inhibits your prefrontal cortex.
That's bad.
So, you know, that's bad. That's really bad. I mean, if you have an intention to use it, so if you have an intention to go and use your phone, that's fine. But if it's a habit and it's a real bad habit, that can inhibit this part of your brain that you're trying to optimize.
Right.
So
throw your phone in the freaking ocean, Rory.
I'm close to doing it. Really am. If that's what it takes for me to get more into that.
If flow, if you can tap back into that flow from Sunday in Canada, or what Steph Curry can do with the effort and the ease of just your God-given muscle reaction and your cortex, everything's all flowing, then whatever you got to do, buddy, you should start faxing people.
I 100%. Get a pager and do that again.
Totally. Get a pager.
But LeBron does it. LeBron puts his phone away for the playoffs, gets into that playoff mode. And
he does.
There's definitely something to it.
Want more Rory and Carson? Head on over to golfpass.com for full video of the show and other originals like My Daily Routine.
So when you leave Canada, you must be feeling like heading into the Open at Pebble. My God, I'm unconscious. I'm going to get back into that flow. Like, what were your thoughts as you got into Monterey?
Yeah, I mean, I think I was just so confident and comfortable with where my game was. I'd just come off shooting, 15 under par for the weekend in Canada. You know, that isn't going to automatically translate to winning the next week, but you know your game's there. So it's about, again, getting the best stuff out of yourself. So I thought that I started the US Open really well. I shot, you know, 68, 69 the first 2 days, and was right in the golf tournament after Friday.
I saw an interview with you, I think, after Canada, before the U.S. Open, where they were talking about the USGA, and I think it was something to the extent that you had said, listen, you know, the USGA has kind of been put on notice for the way these golf courses are set up, and, you know, the PGA, I mean, the Pebble tournament's going to be kind of telling, I think, was, to paraphrase, he was like, we'll sort of see. If they get it right at Pebble, that'll be an indicator of sort of how they're doing. What was your impression?
I think it was the best U.S. Open setup I've played probably in 5 years. I really enjoyed the U.S. Open at Pinehurst in 2014, and I think it was the best setup since then. The one thing that sort of got to me, people were saying it was too easy. It was not easy. It was like, it was...
Well, the first seven holes, maybe, but then that was it.
Yeah, the first seven, but even still, in the first seven holes, you had the second hole, which obviously for the pro-am is a par five.
Now.
It's a par four for us. The third hole is no gimme. The fifth hole, the par three, is no gimme. So
that's
even
sure.
in those first seven holes, you've got three pretty tough holes. You know, the other four you can make birdies or whatever, but it's still like you hit it offline or you hit it out of position. It was tough. And as much as people said that they kept watering the greens at the weekend, the greens were firm at the weekend. They, you know, the ball was taking a huge first bounce. So I thought Gary Woodland, you know, you alluded to him earlier. He I didn't think 13 under par was going to win the golf tournament. I thought eight under par, you know, you shoot 469s that week, you have a really good chance to win. So, you know, Gary played out of his mind and you know, was obviously a very deserving champion.
So, Pam, what do you love in a U.S. Open? What is a perfect U.S. Open to you? Just because, I mean, I grew up, it was obviously high rough, you know, beast of a golf course, the ultimate test. Did Pebble present itself that way? Because it's not that long.
No, it's not. And you need to do some. That, I think that's the thing. If the USGA are committed to going to these traditional venues where it's not that long anymore, and you know the modern equipment has sort of made these golf courses outdated, they need to do things that are sort of borderline to get the score the way, you know, like it was very obvious that they didn't care that even par was going to win the championship this year, and that's the way it should be, because even though they don't say it, they try to manufacture the golf course and they try to make sure that the winning score is always around even par. But in this day and age, with the technology that we have, with the way the players are and the knowledge and everything else, you know, what's wrong with making a few birdies? And you know, it's at the end of the day, it's only a number. The guy that takes the least amount of strokes is the guy that's going to win. You know, it doesn't matter if that's even par, 13 under, whatever. So I thought they got it spot on this year, and I hope that they continue to do that year on year, because it was fair. You played good golf, you got rewarded. If you played bad golf, you didn't. You know, you got punished. And I think sometimes at U.S. Opens, you feel like you play good golf and you get punished, and that's what you don't want. And that's, I think, what had happened the last couple of years.
Well, you've been driving the ball so just incredibly well this year. I think the best driving performance I've ever seen on tour. I'm sure it was a little bit frustrating given the length of Pebble that you couldn't take full advantage of it, but it was a great week nonetheless. Producer Ryan, what do you got there?
I just wanted to back up to the interesting story from the Canadian. So take us through it, because I think I saw a clip of it. But someone handed you a Kyle Lowry jersey, and you handed them your putter.
So yeah, it was
Why did you hand somebody your putter?
So yeah, I don't know. it was the director of Golf Canada, Lance Tenenbaum, I think.
I think you're correct. Yes.
So he gave me the Kyle Lowry jersey and said, "Hold this up, the fans will love it." Obviously, they were in the middle of. The Raptors were in the middle of winning the NBA Finals, and you know, I didn't feel like I needed to, you know, I don't endear myself to the fans that much more. But you know, I held it up, and I guess I had the putter, and we just sort of switched, and I got back up to the scoring area, and I said to my caddy Harry, "You've got the putter, haven't you?" And he goes, "No, I haven't got your putter." I go, "Where is it?" "Oh shit, I need my putter. I need my putter for Pebble."
Who had it?
So this guy, the director of Golf Canada, Lance, he had it, but we got it back. It was fine. But
are you sure it's the same putter?
It's the same putter. But it was a scary sort of 15 or 20 minutes trying to sort of scramble to get this thing before we headed to Pebble Beach.
How freaked out would you have been if it wasn't your actual putter? Are you superstitious? Like, would your team just get you the exact same specs on a putter and you would be just fine with it?
No, after just doing what I did then and shooting 61 and winning the tournament, no, I wouldn't have been fine with it.
Yeah, you want that putter.
Maybe after another week, I might have been okay. I might have gladly have given the putter away, depending on how the performance
went.
Well,
listen, you were pissed you didn't shoot 59, so F that putter. You should have given it away.
it was more my iron shots into 16 and 18. But anyways, that's a different story.
I got it.
You know, someone stole Ben Hogan's one iron, the famous one iron from 1950.
I saw it at Pebble. So I think it was donated to the USGA Museum at one point. They had a lot of cool artifacts. So we'd had every 5 years they do a champions dinner.
Yeah.
And all the US Open champions get together. They have dinner. It's really cool.
That, yeah.
You know, Jack was there and Lee Trevino and a lot of the old guys and telling stories and stuff. It was a lot of fun. But the USGA brought some of the artifacts from the museum, and they had the golf ball that Bobby Jones won the Grand Slam with in Marion in 1929.
Wow.
They had Hogan's one iron. They had the first ever medal from the U.S. Open in 1895.
For sure.
Wow.
I mean, all that stuff. It was really, really cool. I mean, I'm a huge fan and geek of, you know, history of the game. And
yeah,
seeing that stuff that night was really cool.
There's actually a great room at Marion. If you're ever there, there's a great room that they run, and it's got all those, a lot of those artifacts in there.
Yep.
The guy's name is John Capers, I believe. John Capers. Yeah, we went up there to shoot something, and this room, Carson, for anybody who's a golf nut and has access to Marion Country Club, however you can get it, you'll have to take your hat off first of all. But then you go up into this room, and it's this old school like barn door. And you open it up, and it's got like old newspaper clippings from the Philadelphia Inquirer and all the stories of Hogan from 1950. It's really, really like, I mean, you're just pulling, you're like foldering through golf history.
It's an archival room at Marion that you can learn about. It's not like a hotel room.
Correct. It's an archive like above the locker room. It's literally can't be more than 10 by 11.
I'll tell you what, at some point in one of these podcasts, we should do something and do like a tribute to the history of golf, because I know how much it means to you, Rory. And I grew up at Riviera playing with a kid named Jeff Shackelford, who's done some stuff for the Golf Channel.
Yeah, he's a big course design guy.
And so Shaq does a lot of the course design stuff, but he wrote a book about the history of Riviera, and he knows the stuff like inside and out. He'd be a great guest for the podcast to really go there, because some really great stories about, you know, golf yesteryear that I would find fascinating as well.
I saw one of his pieces on Pebble Beach during the U.S. Open week, which was really cool. All the old photos of Pebble, the way it was when it first built.
I love it.
Yeah, it's cool.
Yeah, he does a great job. One quick thing before we move on to Royal Portrush about the USGA, because I'm just curious, my own knowledge. Correct me if I'm wrong, there's at some point over the last 10 years or however many years, there's been a little bit of, a disconnect, some would refer to it as, between the USGA and tour players. Mm-hmm. Now, whether that's true or not, I don't know. What I do know is that Jason Gore is a golfer on tour who I grew up with and consider like family. He's like one of my family members. We played AT&T Pebble Beach every year together
until
he lost his card. So Jay Gore text me recently and says, I'm moving to New Jersey. I live in New York. I'm like, oh my God, our families are going to be able to hang out together. And it turns out he got this job acting as basically a liaison between the USGA and the PGA Tour. Yeah. At the US Open, he was there. He helped set up the course, I know. Tell me a little bit about that. Is he really making a difference?
Yeah, I think the USGA have really made an effort to get the players on side, right? It's obviously, Jason is a part of that, but I think it's a bigger push towards trying to align themselves. I think, you know, a lot of the tour players, you know, it's an amateur organization. A couple of things that have happened in the U.S. Open. I call even the stuff that happened at Oakmont, you know, I called it amateur R in a tweet, because it was, you know, if it had have been officials that deal with these guys week in, week out, you know, the situation would have been handled in a couple of minutes and play would move on, instead of letting it linger for the whole back nine to decide the tournament.
Yeah, that
so was weird. I think there has been, you know, a big effort put forth from the USGA to just try and bridge that gap a little bit. And Jason has been very visible. He's been out on tour. He's been on ranges asking guys their opinion. So that's been a big help also, for sure.
Well, I'm sure they just put him there for at least there's somebody that you guys can yell at, and whether or not anything's going to happen, who knows, but you're right. Maybe it's a step in the right direction.
Looking for a quick fix to help your game? Our original series, Breaking 100, is your answer. Learn more with a 7-day free trial on golfpass.com.
So you set the course record at Royal Portrush when you were 16 years old. I don't know anything about that area. Give me a little history lesson on this golf course and you.
Yeah, so every year it goes way before even when I played in it. But there's a tournament called the North of Ireland Amateur Championship that's played at Portrush every year in July, and I first went to Portrush to watch my dad play in this tournament when I was 6, 7, 8 years of age.
Oh, cool.
So my dad, he actually played Graham McDowell in one of the match play matches, and
oh
Graham
my God,
beat
you're
him.
So
but,
young.
You know, so, but, so it was really, that was my first, you know, encounter with Royal Portrush. And then I grew up and I wanted to play in the North of Ireland, and it was something, you know, my dad played in it. It was a big deal at the time. And I played as a 16-year-old, and there's a little course there which is called the Valley or Rathmore, which is actually the course that GMAC grew up on.
Yeah.
And then the Dunluce Links, which is the course we're playing for the Open Championship in a couple of weeks' time. I played that the second day. So it's two rounds of qualifying, and then the top 64 make it into the match play. And this was the second round of qualifying, and I'd shot 71 on the Valley golf course, and then obviously shot 61 the next day. You know, I, as a 16-year-old, I think the lowest round I'd ever shot before was like maybe 5 or 6 under. Like, I'd never ever went that deep, and
right.
And you know, to have a round like that and do it there, you know, with my dad watching, I think my dad never broke 75 around there, and then for me to go and shoot 61 was pretty cool.
You probably
cool.
But, had to walk home.
Yeah, exactly. But it was like I think at that point as well, I never in a million years did I think that an Open Championship would be played again at Royal Portrush. You know, the last time it was played there was 1951.
Yeah.
Max Faulkner won the tournament. I think he won £300 for winning back then. So to think about where just the game of golf is nowadays, and to think that the Open's coming back to Portrush after 60 whatever years, it's really, really cool. So I'm so excited. I can't wait to get back home. Even though that Jupiter, Florida is now my home, you know, it's where I spend most of my time. You know, Northern Ireland will always be home to me.
Right.
And to be able to play a major championship at home in front of all my friends and family is just going to be the coolest thing.
So the course is rated one of the hardest links courses in the world. It's over, I guess it's, and you'll know, but let us in on this. How much prep have they done? I understand quite a bit for the Open.
Yeah, so Portrush has always been ranked in the top 10 golf courses in the world. It's amazing. So there's two golf courses. Northern Ireland is such a small part of the world, but we have two of the top 10 golf courses in the world ranked annually, which is unbelievable. And I think I took that for granted as well when I was growing up, to think that, you know, and it's so Portrush is designed by Harry Colt, who also designed Royal Liverpool, where I won the Open in 2014. And he also designed Hamilton Country Club, where I just won the Canadian Open. So I've had some pretty good success on Harry Colt courses. You know, they have done some extensive. So, yeah, as you said, the original 17th and 18th holes have been taken out of play, and they've built two new holes for the Open. So it's a new seventh hole and a new eighth hole. So the way the course used to be, the course that I shot 61 on, the old 16th is now the 18th hole. So it's going to be a little bit different, but you know, it's still a very similar golf course to the one that I grew up playing.
Wait, so is the 16th hole still a par three? It says
no. So the 14 is the famous par three. It's called Calamity.
Yeah, that was 16 at some point, wasn't it?
No, that is now 16. It used to be 14.
I got it.
Yeah, so that's going to be a pretty pivotal hole in the outcome of the tournament, I think.
So you're on this 3 week off, and before you head there, what are your top three priorities to get into the flow that you had when you were 16 years old, or that you had in Canada? By the way, you've got Harry Colt going for you, so like maybe that's all the cerebral flow you need. What are your 1, 2, 3? What are you working on?
I noticed a pebble. My alignment got a little bit left. I started aiming too far left, especially with some of the cut shots I was playing. So I hit two really good shots into the 18th hole at Pebble the last 2 days, but I felt like I was aiming at sort of left side of the green, left edge of the green. And then I watched some videos back, and I was aiming it pretty much in the water. I was aiming it like, I was aiming sort of at the wall. So if I start to aim too far left, then I'll pull the club behind me on the takeaway. And then I can start missing it both ways. I can start flaring it out to the right, or I can start to hit too much of a big hook. So I worked a little bit on alignment this week.
Yeah.
And then I think one of the big things I learned from Canada was freedom. Just have, you know, I went out in the final group with Webb Simpson, and I wanted to play aggressive. I took driver off the first. I wanted to put my foot down from the start, and I played with the freedom that I wanted to play with. And I think if I can continue to play with that freedom and not be as careful or as tentative when I get myself into these pressure situations, it's going to be the best way for me to produce the golf that I produced in Canada.
Does freedom to you mean swinging away? If you're in between clubs, And Harry says, "Hey, let's knock down the seven and hang on, you know, hold on to it a little bit." And you say, "No, I'm gonna flush the eight." Like, give me like real world examples of the freedom. Like, what does that feel like to you?
Yeah, so freedom would be more.
Is it opposite of conservative?
I think as well. I think you can have a conservative strategy, but you need the freedom of, you know, you need the freedom of swing, and so. I think one of the big things for me in Canada was I was so free off the tee. I drove it really well. I hit driver a lot. You know, I made that a real big, you know, advantage for me.
Yeah.
But as you said, if Harry says, you know, hold, I think it's more the commitment side of it. So if you want to hold the little seven, that's fine. But 100% commit to it and take dead aim. And, you know, sometimes when I get myself... I go back to when I played with Tiger in the final group at the Tour Championship last year. I was hanging on a little bit. I was being a little careful. I was hitting it into middle of greens. I was two or three shots behind starting off. I should have been firing at flags and you know giving myself chances and trying to make birdies. And I was just a little too conservative and too tentative. And
you'll take that to Royal Portrush. I mean, you go off one on Thursday or wherever you go. You're gonna try and replicate that mentality of let's put my foot on their throat.
Yeah. So I think one of the phrases that I've used recently is give myself permission. I want to give myself permission to be free. Give myself permission to storm the castle. You know, it's one of the things we do. If I want to go and storm the castle, so it's just saying, you know what, it's okay if whether you win. I'd rather lose playing that way than lose playing conservatively and not even giving myself a chance. You know, I'd rather play to win, and I guess that's sort of what I'm. You know, I want to do more of that, and I proved to myself in Canada that I can really do that.
Yeah, how different are the galleries in the UK versus US?
A lot different. You know, galleries in the UK are there to watch golf for the most part. I think there's a lot of, you know, there's a lot of other extracurricular things that happen around a golf tournament in the US, which is a great thing because it brings new fans to the sport and it brings, you know, new people. It exposes them to golf. But in the UK, they are golf nuts. And it's they're just a little more knowledgeable and maybe a little more appreciative of a good shot or a bad shot or a challenging situation, or, you know, they understand the nuances of the game maybe a little bit more than the American crowds do.
They get excited over like a well-flighted ball or a great layup. Like, that's the thing you notice over there.
I think. And it's a bit like, if you're a real baseball fan, you're going to love the nuances of the game and where if you're a casual fan, you don't really get into it that much. And I think that's just that.
A real baseball fan knows when a catcher calls a great game for a pitcher, you know?
Yes.
A casual baseball fan knows that, you know, one team had more home runs.
Wait, so you're telling me the UK galleries are more in tune with the nuance of the game and they're more polite than in Phoenix?
Yes. Yeah, well, that's
anybody's more polite than Phoenix. That's a bad example.
That's a generalization, obviously, but
I thought it was the other way around. I thought during the Ryder Cup, the sing-songing, the beers clanking, the flowing, the Europeans seem like they show up, you know, ready to party. Like, they seem almost more patriotic. It always seems like it's an issue of nationalism to the UK galleries. When I see them, that's what I feel. Whereas in the United States, it's like, we're going to go check out a golf tournament, but, like, meanwhile, we're going to go to the Knicks tonight, like, we're spoiled in the United States. I get a real sense of passion more so there than I do here.
Yeah, I think you're probably right. It probably means a little bit more to them, and it maybe is a little bit more important to them in the UK because they don't get a lot of big golf tournaments every year. You know, the Open's obviously the big one, and, you know, there's maybe a handful of others where... You know, the market here is saturated. You've got golf, you've got football, you've got basketball, you've got baseball, you've got, I mean, there's so much going on.
College football, college basketball.
Oh my gosh,
You know,
tailgating left and right.
Yeah, no, it's a fair point. But I think as well, the fans in the, you're talking about Ryder Cups, they bring that football or soccer side of things to, so all those songs that you hear at the Ryder Cups, they're all football songs, but the just yeah. lyrics are changed. You know, they'll they'll sing the same tunes and about different things, but they're all from football.
Right, right.
Which is cool, which is really cool.
What do you miss most about North Ireland, living there?
I like it feels like one big sort of village. It's a tiny place. I mean, the whole country, there's 1.7 or 1.8 million people. It's just, people, I think when I go back there, and not that this isn't the case here in Florida or in the United States, but, you know, people are genuinely happy for you whenever you, you know, whenever you do well and come home, and, you know, they feel like your success is their success too in some way. And, you know, that's cool.
Do you think it's like you're just Rosie and Jerry's boy as opposed to Rory McIlroy, superstar golfer, like when you go home there?
When I go back to Hollywood, where I'm from, where the town that I grew up in,
How far is that from Royal Port Rush?
About just over an hour's drive, maybe like a 70-minute drive.
Pretty
close.
So
not too far. But that's basically from one end of the country to the other. I mean, that's as big as it is. But yeah, when I go home, I'm definitely just Rosie and Jerry's boy. But for, you know, to the wider, you know, the wider sort of country that don't know me, obviously I'm maybe something else to them. But yeah, when I go home and I go to my local golf club that I grew up at, I'm still treated as the same person, which I appreciate.
I had the great honor of going to Ireland to watch U2 play, and I went with the Red Hot Chili Peppers from the States, and we flew into Dublin, and U2 played a show at Slane Castle, which is a very special place for them to play. It's a dividing line. They recorded their album, The Unforgettable Fire, at this place. It burned down, which is why they named the album The Unforgettable Fire. So it was a real point of history for the band U2. When I landed in Shannon, flew to Dublin, I brought my mom because we're Irish and we were going to, you know, see where our family was from. Bono's father had passed away that weekend. So now we're seeing a show with all this crazy symbolism at Slane Castle. The last time U2 played there was in 1973. They opened up for Thin Lizzy. Now Bono's father's passed away, and he's there saying, "You're going to see the most incredible concert." This, he dedicates it to his father under the Irish sky. And my mom and I are like bawling. It was incredible.
That's awesome.
But the point of the story is that after the show, we flew back to Dublin, and we went to a bar, and I was amazed at how the locals let Bono and the band be. They were the sons of Ireland, and the people, I'm from LA, you know where I'm from. I'm from the exact opposite of this mentality, where we bastardize and use our celebrities. I want to rub shoulders with so-and-so and get a selfie. Meanwhile, the culture there was so different. I was so shocked, and I was thinking about you going back to Royal Port Rush. Will you be able to sort of, you know, is it going to be terrible or is it going to be okay?
I think it's going to be okay. I mean, but even if it was terrible and you talk about those things that might happen, well, and I think nowadays it is worse because everyone has a camera and has a phone and can take selfies and, you know, what, like, that's just the way the world is. But, like, what a unique opportunity for me to go and play a major championship at home with all these people wanting you to do well. I mean, it's, you know, I've talked about it before that I don't want that to be a burden. I want that to, you know, I want to use that energy and I want to ride that wave of momentum that they give me. And it's almost like the 15th club in my bag. You know, that's sort of what I hope the crowds will be like there. It's a, you know, I know that I'll get an unbelievable support, and, you know, as long as I let that lift me up instead of weigh me down, you know, that's going to be awesome.
Do you have a biography? Have you written a biography, Carson? Because I would love to hear more about Red Hot Chili Peppers and you two
flying over there
with them.
I have great stories on that trip. I swear it was great. Chad Smith, the drummer of the Chili Peppers, a friend of mine, and sort of invited me, and I took my mom. Aaliyah died that weekend. There was a pop star, 22 years old, named Aaliyah. Yeah. She died that weekend flying home from a Hype Williams video. It was being shot in the Bahamas, and I had to go. I only know it because I woke up in Dublin in a hotel room so hungover with my mom from this night at U2, and I worked at MTV, and they called me and said, "You got to come home. There's been an accident," and, like, I had to, like, go to work. So that's just one weekend. So that would be the book. The biography would be basically that story. Every other story I could never tell in public. It has to do with a spring break in Jamaica or Mexico, so that would never happen. But listen, Rory, we got to wrap up this issue of the podcast. Buddy, best of luck at home, and I love where you seem to be at mentally over this past year of not putting too much pressure on yourself. Honestly, it's one of the things I love about Koepka. I know we go back to him for a second. As a fan, I like the fact that golf isn't his life. I like the fact that he, you know, may have to muster up energy on any given Sunday. I'm okay with that because I'm like that. I love that you have put golf in a place with your beautiful wife and your life that it's not dominating every fiber of your body. I think it's great.
No, and I think that's the, you know, you just touched on it there. I think having balance in your life makes everything else better. So, like, whether it's Brooks, you know, having that life away from golf, that probably makes his golf better, even though people would have a different, you know, they would put a different spin on it. It's the same thing. Like, I sometimes get guilty that I don't hit a golf shot for a week, but I come back and I'm like, oh, I still remember how to do this. Like, why am I feeling right. guilty that I haven't practiced or worked hard for a week? It's like
you're aimed way too far left, but you're doing it.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, I'm getting by.
You're aimed at the wall and 18 at Pebble, but you're there. Yeah.
Listen, but it hits the green, so it's fine.
Yeah, you hit the green. All the best to you. God bless. Have a great week at home, and we'll be watching, and we'll see you on the next podcast.
Sure. Thank you, Carson.
For more of Rory and Carson, head on over to golfpass.com and check out our watch section, where you'll also find your favorite Faraday episodes and tons of documentary and instruction originals. Join today with a 7-day free trial on golfpass.com.